Hello, this is Dr. Jeff Oswald at Concordia Seminary with another session of Lectionary at Lunch. In this session, we want to look at the Gospel for the fifth Sunday in Lent for the Year A readings. And as was true with last Sunday's Gospel, this Gospel amounts to almost an entire chapter of John. The lectionary does give you the option of a somewhat abbreviated reading, but here too, again, like with John 9, John 11 is such a well-connected story that it's unfortunate if we can't take the time and at least read through it together so that your people can hear the whole thing. So for this session, I will plan to go through the entire section, the most inclusive version of the reading from verse 1 through verse 53. By way of introduction, Barrett in his commentary says that this, which is the most striking miracle story in John, is narrated in the plainest and most matter-of-fact style. And again, the comparison with John 9 shows much less of the kind of dramatic artistry we saw there in the interchanges between the healed blind man and his questioners, his final meeting with Jesus, and this story, in fact, the miracle, as someone has pointed out, is narrated in just two brief verses with a lot of build-up toward it. And then what's happening in the larger story almost immediately takes over in the aftermath. Craig Keener, in his two-volume commentary on John, which provides so much rich historical and cultural background, provides some helpful information in this passage with regard to Jewish burial customs of the time, at least what we know and can reconstruct from the material we have. He notes that although graves were often dug straight down into the earth, caves were also used, and the word John uses here in chapter 11 for the tomb of Lazarus is the word for cave. Jews did not embalm the bodies of their dead as the Egyptians did, and so the concern about a body being already in advanced stages of decomposition and the smell that would produce, these are very real concerns. So that's why in other accounts of burials we read of spices being placed in the tomb to neutralize the smell. The stone that was placed over the opening to the tomb, whether it was a vertical pit into the ground or a horizontal cave, in both cases, this was also very practical to prevent especially animals from disturbing the body, but also, of course, people from coming into contact with a dead body or those who would want to do malicious mischief to the body. It was common to return to the tomb in 1 year to gather the bones from the body that had now decayed so that only bones were left, to gather those bones and rebury them in a separate place. And most of us by now have seen pictures of ossuaries, these boxes that are specially created for holding these bones of a loved one. Although some commentaries mention the superstition that the soul of the deceased remained close to the body for 3 days after death, and then the person was beyond hope of resuscitation, there is some little evidence for that, but it seems to play no role whatsoever in our text as John tells the story. Let's get right into John 11 then. Starting at verse 1, Ein detis asthenon, Lazarus apa Bethanias. Some have said this isn't a very majestic beginning for an account of the resurrection of a man from the dead, but it's a common enough way to begin a story. There was a certain man, asthenon, from astheneo there, the present participle, who was sick, who was suffering with an illness. And then the positive, simply nominative here, giving his name, Lazarus from Bethany. The name Lazarus is a shortened form of Eliezer, and it, by etymology, would mean God helps. And although it's possible that there's some hint of that in this story, John certainly doesn't bring out the meaning of the name here the way he does in some other places, as we saw last week with the name of the pool of Siloam, for instance. The only other place, as you might recall, where Lazarus is used in the New Testament is in the parable in Luke chapter 16, one of several connections between this passage and Luke, where there a poor beggar named Lazarus dies, and the rich man, who was cruel to him during life, or at least unmerciful and feeling, then asks that Lazarus, this Lazarus, be sent back from the dead to warn his family. That, of course, does not happen in the parable. But again, it's interesting to note the two Lazaruses we have in the New Testament. The apaw here in verse 1 gives Lazarus's location. He is from Bethany, and we're told that this is the village, Tais Comes, where Marias Kai Marthas, Mary and Martha, Tais Adelphais Autais, Martha, that is the sister of Mary, this is the village where they live. We are then told that it was this Mariam, that it was Mary, that Mary was the one who, you see the article there with the participle, aleipsasa, who anointed the Lord with myro, with ointment or perfume, kai ek maxasa tus podos autu tais thrixin autais, and who, from ek maso, to wipe off or to wipe dry, wiped his feet, then dative of instrument, with her hair. And then we have the relative pronoun whose brother, Lazarus, was ill. That is, Lazarus was the brother of this Mary that we know from another story, and he's the one now who's suffering from an illness. The incident of Mary anointing the feet of her Lord has not yet been told by John. And yet John assumes that his reader is already familiar enough with the story to be able to identify which Mary, out of several who appear in the gospel story, which Mary it is he's talking about. So either the readers are familiar with the sort of New Testament or stories of Jesus in general, or John may be assuming they're familiar with one of the other gospels. Okay, verse 3. Ap estelon un hai adelphai pros auton legusai. This is ap estelon from apostello, to send forth on a particular mission or for a particular purpose. We usually expect a person and a purpose, but here you just have this completed with a participle, legusai. Here the sisters had something done. That is, they had words sent to Jesus. Essentially, they sent someone to say in their place. And so you simply have the verb with the participle. Kyria, ide, hon phileis asthene. Lord, in the vocative, ide, a particle, but really an imperative of eidon, here in its proper setting of a second person singular command, look or behold, take notice. Hon phileis, the one whom you love, the relative pronoun there again, whom you love, he is sick. So the one you love is sick. You'll notice throughout this pericope that phileo and agapao are used so interchangeably that it's hard to even suggest any difference in nuance or shade of meaning between the two verbs. We'll see that happen with laos and ethnos too, for two different words for people or nation. Okay. Verse 4, akousas deha Jesus apen. Having heard this, the aorist participle of akouo, then Jesus said, haute he asthenia uk esten prosthanaton, al hyper tes doxes tu theu. This illness, that is the one that's just been announced to them by the messengers, is not prosthanaton, to death. Not in the sense that it's not a fatal illness, but that the final end of this illness's course will not be death. Rather, it's not to end in death, but it's to end in the glory of God. It's for the sake of the glory of God. And here I think Barrett has a helpful discussion of the force of hyper with a thing rather than a person, and again advises that the translation has to be based on the context, and suggests here that it's not in order that God be praised or glorified, but in order to reveal or show forth the glory of God. And this will be made clear later on in the passage. And he adds what I think is a very fitting summary note in the case of John's gospel especially. The glory of God is not his praise, but his activity. So God does things that manifest his glory. Here, too, you can already begin to see some close formal similarities between chapter 11 and chapter 9. If we do another couple of verses, we can stop and note how similar the beginnings of the two stories are. Verse 4 concludes then with a hina purpose, hina doxas the ha huias tu theu di autes. The purpose of the illness now, the hina goes back to asthenia, is that the Son of God might be glorified through it. Then continuing with verse 5, agapa de ho Jesus ten marathon, kai ten adolfein autes, kai ton lazaron. The agapa there from agapao, imperfect. Jesus, sort of, we wouldn't normally say was loving, but here the force of the imperfect shows that this is his continual relationship with them in the past. Jesus loved them, Martha and her sister and Lazarus. This prevents the possible misunderstanding of what's going to follow, where at first glance Jesus might not seem very loving or thoughtful. Then verse 6, hos un ekuzen hoti asthene, tata men emenin ento hein topo duo hemeras. So then, when the un and the hos, so then when he heard, and then the hoti gives the content of what he heard, when he heard that he was sick, then, that is, Lazarus was sick, then Jesus remained en ho ein topo, in the place where he was. Again, the word order here might throw you a minute, but Barrett says here the attraction of the relative and antecedent into the same clause is a fairly common kind of construction for John. And you can see there's a certain kind of economy of words in saying it this way. So he remained where he was in the same place, with accusative of time here, duo hemeras, for two more days. Carson makes a point that's worth keeping in mind if you read from the NIV in your service. He said the NIV's opening of verse 6 is without linguistic defense. They make it concessive, yet when he heard. And this makes it sound like there's a contrast between his love for this family and his behavior toward them. Carson says the point of the story is just the opposite. Hos un should be translated something like, when therefore he heard, this is what he did. The two-day delay is motivated by Jesus' love for Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. And then he adds, but does that make sense? How can this be? A more lengthy discussion of the purpose here of Jesus' motive that ends in a way I think is very persuasive, given that this is in John's Gospel, comes in Barrett's commentary, where he first notes that John does not specifically say why Jesus remained there. It's not likely that Jesus was waiting for Lazarus to die so that he could perform a miracle that would somehow show forth God's glory in an unprecedented way, because Jesus, according to the story, would already have known that Lazarus was dead when this report of his illness reached him. A more likely view, and I agree here with Barrett, is that John wants to underline here, or I would say rather, that Jesus again wants to reinforce the idea that the time for his trip to Jerusalem, which means more than simply healing a friend, this is the trip to Jerusalem that will mean death for Jesus himself. This was to be determined solely by the will of his Father and his purpose in doing his Father's work. Neither human need nor human affection would drive him to Jerusalem at an inappropriate time, and yet acting the way he does also then shows forth or reveals the glory of God. Okay, verse 7, epeta meta tuta lege tus mathetais. Then, after this, that is, after the delay just mentioned, the disciples, he says to the disciples, agomen estein judaion, Paulin. Let us go again into Judea. With the agomen there, the subjunctive of exhortation, what I often call the salad subjunctive, because we always translate it, let us go into Judea. Verse 8, legusin auto hoi mathetai. The disciples say to him, that is to Jesus, Rabbi, nun e zetun se lithasai, hoi judaioi, kai palin hip ages eche? Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking, desiring, trying their hardest to stone you, to kill you by stoning. And you want to go there again, with hippago being completed simply by the thought of the adverb there, to that place. Apokrithe Jesus, Jesus answered, Uhi dodeca orai horai eisen tes hemeras. Remember, uhi, which is an emphatic form of u, expects an affirmative answer, a yes answer. It's true, isn't it, that there are 12 hours, we would say in a day, but you see in the Greek with the genitive, it's of the day. 12 hours belong to the day. And of course, we might question that, but the day was divided into the daylight period of our 24 hours was divided into 12 equal periods. And so that's what Jesus is referring to here. Antis peripate inte hemera u proskopte hoti tu fos tu cosmu tutu blepe. Here we have an and the subjunctive in peripate followed by proskopte, the present. So that you have a present general or fifth-class condition. If this first thing is ever true, the second one is always true. If someone walks around in the day, during the day, u proskopte, he doesn't stumble. He doesn't bump into things. Proskopto actually has the idea of sort of bruising yourself by hitting into something, but it can also entail the idea of falling to the ground. Now, why is this general truth true? Hoti tafos tu kosmu tu tu blepe, because he sees the light of this world. That seems like very strange language. Why didn't you just say, because it's light and he can see? Obviously, Jesus is pointing to more than simple daylight here and more than simple falling and walking. He's talking about the way life is lived before God. Verse 10 then gives the negative side of this. An de tis peripate en te nukti pros kopte. Same form of condition. The only change is the night for day and the deletion of the negative. If, on the other hand, someone walks around in the nighttime during the night, during the dark period, he does stumble. Hoti tafos uk estin en auto. Because the light is not in him. And here we can clearly see that Jesus is referring, although somewhat indirectly or obliquely, to himself as the light of the world and his presence with someone as the light which will keep them from stumbling. Tauta apen, he said these things, kai meta tuta lege autois, and after this, then he says to them, Lazarus, ha philos hemon, ke koimetai. Lazarus, our friend, has fallen asleep. This is the perfect passive of koimao, and has a double sense already in ancient times of the sleep, sort of the nightly sleep of slumber or the sleep of death. Allah, but poruomai hina ex hypniso auton. But I am, with the contrast there with Allah, poruomai, I go in order to, giving the purpose here with a verb of going, that I might, ex hypniso is the future of ex hypnizo, which means to wake up or arouse him, that is Lazarus. Now, even though the verb for sleep does have the sense of nighttime, nightly sleep or death, there's no examples of this verb being used in a figurative way to wake someone from death. And I think the reasons there aren't too hard to figure out. Verse 12, Epan un hoi mathe tai auto. Then the disciples said to him, Kyrie, invocative Lord, a kekoi metai sothesetai. If he has fallen asleep, sothesetai, he will be saved. That's the way it seems like it should be translated, with the future passive of sozo. And even bedeg suggests to preserve from natural danger, save from death. But the meaning of the passive here is probably save from death in the sense of recover from an illness, not be saved from damnation, or that sort of transcendent sense of salvation. In other words, the disciples think, well, if he's been able to sleep and rest, that's the best thing for him. That's a sign of certain recovery. 13. Eireke de ha Jesus peritu thanatu autu. But Jesus, eireke, the pluperfect of apon, so Jesus had spoken peritu thanatu autu concerning his death. But ekenoi, that is the disciples, they edoxon from dakeo, they supposed here wrongly, hoti, that concerning tes koimezeos tu hypnu lege. They supposed that he was speaking concerning peri, and here the sleep of sleep, the sleep of slumber. These two words are almost synonymous, and you can see the redundancy, or what seems like repetition, is certainly to clarify which of the two meanings of koimeseos John wants the reader to understand. We would probably say they thought he was talking about normal sleep, not death. 14. Tota un apen autois ha Jesus paresia. Then, therefore, Jesus said to them, paresia can have a variety of meanings. Here, it seems to mean plainly in the sense of no longer using figurative language, no more metaphors. He says very straightforwardly, Lazarus ap ethanon. Lazarus died. And the aorist for of apathnesco here is probably significant. Jesus doesn't say he's dead, but that he died in the sense of he had the experience of passing through death. He won't remain dead, as we shall see. Verse 15 is perhaps the most startling verse so far. Kai chairo di himas hina pistuseite. And so remember how this starts in 14. Lazarus died, and I am rejoicing. The opposite of the expected reaction to the knowledge of a loved one's death. I rejoice di himas. Here, dia with the accusative. For your sake, on account of you, that all of this is happening for your good or for your best interest. And what might that be? The purpose of this, then, hina pistusete, that you might, with aorist subjunctive here, come to faith, come to be believing. Hoti uk amen eche. And this goes back then to what he's rejoicing, the cause of Jesus' rejoicing, because I was not there. I rejoice because my absence means you will have the opportunity to go with me and to see the glory of God revealed. Allah, however, so all that aside, now it's time. Agomen pros auton, let us go to him. 16. Apen un Thomas ha legomenos didymas tois simathe tais agomen kai humes hina apothanomen met autu. I would suggest that whoever's going to read this gospel think carefully about this verse and exactly how you will intone Thomas's words here. Is this sarcasm? Is this despair? Is this courage? Is it faith? Knowing the situation of Thomas at this point in the gospel, there's probably some of several of those things mixed in. But Thomas then said, Thomas, the one who was called Didymus, both Thomas and Didymus mean twin in different ways. There's some debate about whether Thomas was actually used as a proper name at this time. Didymus certainly was. But Thomas, which means the twin, said to his symmathetais, the only place in the New Testament this word appears, his fellow disciples, co-disciples, let us go also in order that, purpose with a verb of going again, apothanomen met autu, that we may die with him. It's not actually all that obvious who the with him means. Does this mean with Lazarus, who is now dead, or with Jesus, for whom a trip to Jerusalem is dangerous, perhaps fatally dangerous at this point? 17. Elthon un ha Jesus, hiren auton. So then, going, having gone, past or aorist participle of erchomai, Jesus herein from Hurisco found him, that is Lazarus, tesseras e de hemeras echonta en to mnemeo. Already e de having 4 days tesseras hemeras in the tomb. This is a rather different use of echo. And here it can mean simply to experience something. And we would translate the phrase something like having lain in the tomb or having been in the tomb already 4 days. Einde he Bethania engis ton Jerusalemon hos apostadion decapente. So now this Bethany, or this village that Jesus has arrived at, is or was near Engis, Jerusalem. Hos apostadion decapente, about 15 stades away from Jerusalem. The lexica and the commentaries will help you with the conversion here, but 15 stades would be less than 3 kilometers, or just a little more than a mile and a half. Now, there are two purposes for this seemingly unimportant or trivial material. First of all, it helps the reader understand why so many people from Jerusalem would be at the house of Mary and Martha. This was close enough that friends, people who wanted to offer their sympathies could easily make this trip. At the same time, it's a reminder to the reader how close Jesus now is, having come to Bethany, how close he now is to Jerusalem, the place where he will be lifted up. Paloi de ekton judaion, ele luthezon prostein marthon kai mariam, hina paramuthezon tai autos peritu adolfu. And this is the point we were just talking about. And many of the Jews, that is, from Jerusalem, ele luthezon, had come, the pluperfect of Erchemai, third plural, had come to Martha and Mary in order, purpose again, paramuthezontai. This is from paramutheomai, and it has the idea of consoling or comforting someone. It's often used in contexts of bereavement, but it's not a Christian word, and its use here is interesting. It seems that it is related to the word we know as myth, to almost console or comfort someone by sharing the familiar stories that bring hope and encouragement. I don't think we can make too much of the word here that John is saying these Jews were not offering Christian comfort. But it is, I think, worth noting that this is not the normal word, which would be parakaleo. Where you know that is more often used in terms of consoling or encouraging, comforting a Christian brother or sister. So they came there to console them concerning their brother, the brother. 20. He un Martha hos ekusen hoti Jesus erketai hip eintesin auto. Now, or un here, and sort of next, Martha, hos ekusen, when she heard that Jesus is coming, she went out to meet him. Hip eintesen, from hip on tao, usually with the person that you meet in the dative. Mary, however, ento oiko, ekathedzata, from kathedzomai, to sort of remain seated. She didn't get up. She simply stayed in the house. Epen un he Martha proston Jesun kyrie e eis hode uk an ap ethanen ha adolfas mu. Martha then said to Jesus, Lord, again vocative, if Ace is the imperfect of Amy. So you have A with an imperfect, and then in the second half you have on with a past tense verb. So this would give us than a contrary to fact conditional in past time, remembering that ami does not have an aorist form. So, Lord, if you had been here, my brother, Adolfosmu, would not have died. Allah, rather, however, Kainun, even now, Oida, I know that, with Hati giving the content of what she knows, Hasa on, I tase, ton tha on, dose, soy, ha tha os. I know that whatever, whatsoever, you ask from Aiteo, God, tantha on, dose, future of Didomi, whatever you ask God, dose, soy, hotha os, God will give to you. So here we have on with a subjunctive followed by future. So again, a future more vivid condition. Whatever you ask, if you ask something, he will give it to you. Where, again, the contingency with hosa'an is placed on the whatever rather than the action of the verb. So whatever you ask, God will give you. Lege aute ha Jesus. Jesus says to her, Anastasitai ha Adolfasu. Your brother will rise from anistemi, the future. He will come back from the dead. Lege auto he Martha. Martha says to him, Oida hoti. I know that. Remember, we started looking at similarities between 11 and 9. We have an initial discussion between Jesus and his disciples about what's going on, with some actual confusion about what's going on the part of the disciples. Now, when Jesus is dealing with the people on the scene, notice the emphasis on oida, and recall the importance of that in chapter 9. Oida hoti anastasitai ente anastase ente eskate hemura. I know that he will rise in the resurrection on the last day. Epen aute ha Jesus, ego eimi he anastasis kai he zoe. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus here is not challenging Martha's faith, not telling her she's wrong. It's certainly not clear, not full, not adequate for what Jesus is about to do. And she will certainly have to readjust her way of looking at life and death in light of what she's about to experience in and through Jesus. And yet, her belief that her brother will rise is a true and valid one. Jesus, in claiming to be life, is almost claiming to be God. If God is the source of life, as we saw back in chapter 5, that life comes from God, and the Son also has life in himself. And he is the one who has come that we might have life and have it abundantly. Resurrection and life, it would seem, are not gifts that Jesus give to people. Rather, they are things that we experience in him. If we think ahead to chapter 15, we would say the branch does not go back again and again to the vine and ask the vine to give it life and fruit. It's only when the branch abides in the vine, when it remains there, when it lives in the vine, that it bears fruit. So to be separated from Christ is to be separated from life. Ironically, Jesus shows by raising Lazarus that death cannot separate the believer from the Christ life, the life that is in him. Kester, I think, also says it nicely when he says Jesus can claim to be the resurrection and the life because he proclaims, he embodies, he is the word of God that evokes faith. and without that word there is no life. Okay. Ha pistuon eis eme kan apophane zesetai. Continuing in verse 25 then. The one who believes, who is believing in me, kan here, is even if he should die, he will live. This certainly, again, must be talking about more than simple death and life, because there would be no if in terms of humans all die. But even in the case of a believer, this death will not end in death, but end in life. Kai pas hazon, kai pistuon, and the one who lives, again, not just who is alive in the normal human sense, but lives in me and believes in me, ume apathane. Here you have the reinforced double negative of ume, again, the strongest way to make negative a statement about the future. It's as if the possibility can't even be considered. He will not die. Eston Iona. He will never die. Pistu es tuta. Do you believe this? Verse 27. Lege auto. Nai kyrie. She uses the simple particle for yes, for affirmation to a direct question. Yes, Lord. I pepistu ka. This is the perfect of pistuo. I have come to be in the faith that is, I have come to believe and I now believe. Hoti su e ha Christos ha huias tu theu ha eston kosmon erchamenos. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one who is coming into the world. Going back to the pepistuka, John often uses forms of believing. The verb occurs 96 times in his gospel, 9 times in his first epistle, even though the noun pistis is never found in the gospel. It's also typical or characteristic of John to use the verb in the perfect, along with perfect forms of gnoskein, or to know. Barrett says the force is something like this. We are in a state of faith and knowledge. I know this. I am convinced of it. I have come to recognize the truth, and I hold on to that truth. I cling to it. So I have come to this faith that you are the Christ. These are probably to be thought of as three parallel titles, Christ, the Anointed One, the Messiah, the Son of God, and the one coming into the world, that is the one the Father has sent, a very developed Christology, and yet it still needs to be informed by the chief Christological, we might say, events, the death and resurrection of Jesus. 28. Kai tuta epusa ap elthen kai ephonesin mariam tain adolphane autes lathra epusa. Okay. And having said this, she went away. She went and called Mary, her sister. The conversation had come to its natural conclusion. If Jesus is who Martha thinks he is, then there is nothing more that needs to be said here. And it's only a matter of waiting and seeing what this Christ, this Son of God, this one who has come into the world, is going to do in the case of her brother who has died. So she goes and gets Mary, her sister, Lathra, secretly, without being noticed, and tells her the following message. Why secretly? Perhaps not to draw attention to Jesus. being so close to Jerusalem with so many people from Jerusalem present, she was just trying to be tactful and discreet and not disrupt the mourners who were grieving with the family. John doesn't really say, Ha didaskalos paristin kai phonese. The teacher, which, as some have pointed out, seems a strange way to refer to Jesus now that she's confessed him to be the Christ, the Son of God. And yet, this is the way Mary Magdalene will speak of Jesus, who is risen from the dead. The teacher is here, paristen, from paremi. The teacher is here, and phonese, he is calling you. We're not told that Jesus was calling Mary, but there's no reason to doubt that John is only recording it once to save time. Ekene de hos ekuzen egerthe taku kai erketa prosauton. But when that one, that is that sister, Mary, when she heard egerthe, she got up quickly, swiftly, at once, immediately, and set off to him, erketa, the imperfect of erkamai. Upo de eleluthe ha Jesus estein komen. Now, Jesus had not yet come into the village. This reminder helps explain why this sort of traveling back and forth to their house. Al ein ete en to topo hapu hip ein tezin auto he Martha. Rather, he was still in the place where hapu Hippaintezen, in that same word, where Martha came out to meet him, where Martha met him. 31. Hoi un yudaioi hoi antes met autes ente oikia, kai paramuthumenoi autain. The fact that John next mentions the Jews almost suggests that some of the secrecy or the distance that Jesus was maintaining had some relationship with them. And yet they're never pictured as hostile toward Jesus or his enemies here, although we'll see at the end of the whole episode, some of them do go and report all of this to the authorities in Jerusalem. For now, however, they just seem to be well-meaning friends and neighbors. The Jews then, who antes, being with her in the house, and paramuthumenoi, and consoling her, autain, idontes, another participle, you have antes present of Amy, idontes aorist of Adon, used as an aorist for Harao. Having seen Mary, that she got up quickly and went out. And here you again have a somewhat peculiar word order where Mary actually gets pulled into the sentence out of it, the haughty clause, having seen that she got up quickly, you would expect, but having seen Mary, that she got up quickly and went out. Ekaluthezon, they followed her. Doxantes, now here you have another group of people who are acting on the basis of opinion, which will turn out to not be well informed, thinking that hippage, she goes, or that she was going to the tomb in order to weep there. This is from Clio. Remember, the spelling changes in the present. Here it's the aorist subjunctive, to weep, wail, to mourn her brother. He un Mariam hos eilthen hapu ein Jesus. When Mary came to where Jesus was, idusa auton, seeing him, epizen autu, prostus podas legusa auto. She fell down, threw herself down at his feet, saying to him, Kyrie, Lord, eis hoda uk anmu ap ethanin ha adolphos. almost word for word the same as Martha had said to Jesus. Another interesting connection with Luke's gospel is that that's the only other place where these two sisters are mentioned. And it's interesting that they act here the way we would expect them to if we know the story of Jesus meeting with them at their home as Luke records it. Their personalities, their behavior seem to be very consistent. It's even a little bit ironic that it seems every story that involves Jesus and Mary ends up with Mary at Jesus' feet. So if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Jesus un hos eiden autein kleiusan, kai tus sin alphantas aute judaeus kleiontas. So Jesus then, when he saw her crying, remember often with verbs of seeing you have an accusative person and then a participle describing what action they're in. So he sees her doing something, he sees her weeping. And the ones who had come along with her, the Jews, also weeping, enebremesata to pneumati. This is one of the most difficult words in the passage. From embremao, Bedag suggests a gloss, something like be deeply moved, which then makes it very serious to tarasso, the verb that follows. Bedag provides a little bit of etymological background that breme can mean strength, but it's also used of bellowing in the sense of a snort, which actually an animal might give off when it's angry. So the explanation Bedag gives is to feel strongly about something. Barrett says it's beyond question that the verb implies anger. The question then becomes, what is Jesus angry about? And let's revisit that question after we finish looking at the passage. So he was angry in spirit, that is, within himself. Whether this showed to anyone is not clear. The language wouldn't require it, but it wouldn't forbid it. Kai etaraxen heauton. And he was troubled or agitated, which does suggest something that those who were there could have seen or noticed. So he was disturbed. He disturbed himself is the way the Greek actually reads. And he said, pu tethekate auton. Pu is the question word for where. Tethekate is the perfect for tithemi, which in classical usage already was sort of a technical term for laying a body in a tomb. Where have they lain him? Legusun auto, kyria, erku kai ida. They say to him, Lord, come. These are imperatives, both of the second singular, come and see. Edakrusen ha Jesus, verse 35. And Jesus wept. Jesus shed tears. This is not quite the same wailing of the a mournful person, but it's the, I guess, the physical or physiological manifestation of this sorrow, this distress or troubling that he felt. Elegon un ha judaioi, ide pos ephile auton. And the Jews then were saying, look or see how ephile, he loved him. They're already speaking in past tense, although Jesus is not yet ready to write off Lazarus into the past tense. Tenes de exauton apon, but some of them said, uk edinata hutas, ha anoixas tus ophthalmus tu tiflu, poiesai, hina kai hutas me apathane. Now here the connection with chapter 9 is made explicit. Uk, remember, expects a yes answer. Sort of, he could have, couldn't he? This one who anoixas opened the eyes of the blind man. He could have made it come about. He could have brought it about that, poieo here with hina, that also this one, that is Lazarus, would not die. He could have brought it about that he didn't have to die. So again, the answer they expect is yes, he could have. And they're left puzzling, why didn't he then? Jesus un palin embrimomenos en auto erketai esta mnemeon. Jesus then, again, being deeply moved, being angered within himself, he comes esta mnemeon to the tomb. Here, ace is already taking over some of the territory of pros, to just come to something, or epi, to the opening, the doorway. This doesn't mean that he entered the tomb. And remember, this is the first time that Jesus is seeing the tomb, so John provides a description of it for us, the readers. Einde spelion, and there was a cave. And lithos ep eketa ep auto, and a stone from ep eketa from epikemai, a stone was lying upon it. And the upon there could mean, you know, covering the doorway up against the opening or flat on the ground if it were that kind of a tomb. Verse 39, Lege ha Jesus, Jesus says, Areta ton lithon, take away from iro, an aorist imperative, second plural, you all take away the stone. Lege auto he adolfe tu tetele lute kotos Martha. Then she says to him, that is the sister of the, this is from telutao and is the perfect participle, the one who has died, namely Martha. Lord, ede otze, tetar tayas gar estin. Again, this seems very in character for Martha, who, and the story we know from Luke, seems very concerned about proper housekeeping and keeping things the way they should be. Lord, ede odze. Lord, it is already smelling. That is in the sense of giving off an unpleasant odor. For, it is 4 days. Tetartaios means something that happens on the fourth day, or on, in this case, that he's been, it's already the fourth day since he was buried. He's been dead 4 days already. Lege aute ho Jesus, Jesus says to her, uk eponsoi, I did tell you, didn't I, that, the content of what he says, if you believe, you will see opse, the future of horao, tein doxon tu theu. This is the verse that Barrett was pointing to when he said, that all this would happen for the glory of God didn't mean that God would be praised, but that his glory would be made manifest. So here a future more vivid condition. If it's ever true that you are believing, then it will follow that you will see the glory of God. So if you believe, you will see. Aaron un ton lithon. Then they took away the stone. I think we can assume that Martha's objections are dropped. Hode Jesus erentus ophthalmus ano kai apen. In Jesus, same verb here, but in a slightly different sense, lifted up his eyes upward. This is the posture for his prayer. And he said, Pater, here in the vocative, eucharistosoi hoti ekousas mu. I thank you that you have heard me. Ego de De Aden hoti pantota mu akues. And I know, this is Aden, the pluperfect of oida. I already knew, that is, that you always hear me. So he had already come to this knowledge before he said this. But dia ton oklon, on account of the crowd, ton periestota, the crowd that is standing around, standing by us here, apon, I spoke. I spoke for their sake, not for mine. Hina pistusosin, so that they might be believing that you, hotisu, me ap estelas, that you sent me. Verse 43, kai tauta epon phone megale ek kraugatsen. Having said these things with a loud voice, with a great voice, ek kraugatsen, from kraugadzo, to cry out, usually strongly, loudly, even harshly. And here, these powerful words shouted out, Lazara, the vocative of form of Lazarus's name, duro exo. Duro is an adverb that really means here. And this syntactic force of this we can, I think, imagine, because we can say, command something like here, now. So without using any verbs, here Jesus is saying, here, outside, that is, come out. Come out here by his command. 44. Ex eilthen ha tethnikos dedemenos tus podos kai taskeras ke reis kai he opsis autu sudario peria dedeta. Ha tethnikos, the man who had died, from thnesko, this is the perfect participle. The man who has died, ex eilthen, came out, dedemenos, the perfect passive participle of deo, having been bound, or still being bound, that is, he was tied up and the bonds were still on him, on his podos, his feet, kaitos cheras, his hands. Now, kerios, ice, are the things he was bound with, tied up with, and they seem to be not so much ropes as some sort of strips of cloth or fabric, some sort of woven material that was used for binding bodies in burial. So with bound with these strips of cloth or binding materials. And heopsis, his face, his countenance, this word too is related to horao, and we just had the future of that, which looks very similar a few verses back. Opse, where you will see back in verse 40. And his face, periadedeta, bound around from perideo, wrapped up in a cloth that was sort of wound around his face. Sudarion is a Latin loan word, which usually simply means a cloth. It can be like a handkerchief that you would wipe away perspiration with, for instance. Here, both the binding materials and the cloth seem to have been to try to preserve as long as possible the appearance of the body of the deceased. Lege autois ha Jesus, and Jesus says to them, Lusata auton. From Luo, aorist imperative, this is your old friend Luo from summer Greek class, unbind him, loose him, let him loose, kai aphete auton hypogen. Aphete from aphiemi, also an aorist imperative, and you sort of let him be, let him actually hypogen, go, don't detain him, and here hypago may mean to go home, to depart, to leave the tomb or a graveyard. Okay. Paloi un ekton judaion hoi elfantos prostein mariam kaitha asamenoi ha epoiesen epistuzan esauton. Then many of the Jews who came to Mary and Theosamenoi from Theaomai who had seen what he did, that is, what Jesus did, epistuzon. They, again, pistuo in the aorist usually means to enter the condition of faith, of belief. They came to faith in him. That's why it's important not to think that the Jews are painted in negative terms when they come to console with Mary and Martha, as if this was somehow hypocritical on their part. Many of them come to believe. Tines de ex auton, but some of them, op elthon, went away, prostus pharisaius, to the Pharisees, kai apen autois, ha epoiesen Jesus, and told them, ha epoiesen, what Jesus did. Verse 47. Sin agagon un hoi achieres, kai hoi pharisaioi, synedrion, kai elegon. Then, calling together, this is the second aorist of synago, to gather together, the high priests and the Pharisees in the nominative. So that's the combined subject. The high chief priests or high priests and the Pharisees called together or summoned or gathered Sanhedrin, the council, the Sanhedrin. A hedra is a seat. So a Sanhedrin is a meeting or a place where you all sit together to carry out business. Here it means a session of the council. So they convened a council meeting, and they were saying, Ti poiumen. Here Barrett says it would be better to put the question mark right there. What are we doing? This is not a deliberative subjunctive. This is the indicative. What shall we do? What are we to do? But what are we doing? And he says that suggests the answer, nothing. Why? And then you continue with the haughty clause here. Haughty hutos ha anthropos. This man, probably derogative, but certainly demonstrative, pointing a finger. This man that they've just heard about, Paula poie semea. Does many signs. And certainly here, John is reminding us that he's done more than the ones that we have seen recorded in his gospel. E'on aphomen auton hutos. Here again, e'on with a subjunctive, and this is from aphiemi, remember we saw it back in verse 44, to let someone be, to tolerate them. If we let him, hutos, thus, in this way, that is, if we let him go on this way, if we let him continue working all these signs, pantes pistiususen, here's our future, to give us a future more vivid again. If this is true, that we let him go on, this is what will inevitably happen. This will follow, that all will believe eisauton in him. Kai elusontai, and someone will come. So a second future verb. So if we let him continue, not only will everyone believe in him, but there will be another result that will follow. Hoi romaioi, the Romans will come. Kai arusen, here iro in the sense of conquer or take control of, take from us, the place, which is almost certainly focused on the temple, but could include the whole city of Jerusalem, kai ta ethnos, the people. And here it can only mean the people of Israel. They'll conquer these and take them completely from our control. Heis detis ex auton. And now you have one of them, or a certain of them, combined with heis and tis together. So a certain one of them, that is, of this assembled council, Ka'iaphas, Caiaphas, archiarus own to eniautu ekenu. being high priest, now in the singular, to Eniautu Ekenu, of that year. Now, there has been a lot of discussion on this passage previously, saying that the high priest in Jerusalem was not appointed or elected to a yearly term, and that for John to say this shows that he must either never have understood what was going on in Jerusalem, or this was so long removed or far removed that he couldn't remember anymore. I think rather the emphasis should be not on that this was annual, which he doesn't say, but the Ekenu, that year, that fateful year, that year when Jesus was put to death, he was the high priest who oversaw the trial, the condemnation, the handing over to crucifixion. He was the high priest that year. Apen autois, he said to them, Humes uk oidate uden, you don't know nothing. And here the uk and the uden emphasize each other rather than canceling each other out. You know nothing at all, nothing whatsoever. Ude, neither nor logizeste, do you consider, do you reckon, do you think at all that symphere humin, symphero means that something can be advantageous. Here it's used in the impersonal third singular form with the dative of the person for whom it's advantageous. Neither do you think or consider that it is better for you that, and hina here gives the thing that is better, and then it's followed by kai me, showing the opposite, what would not be advantageous. That it is better for you that this should happen, a kind of result, so to speak, that this should be the result of all this, that one man, heis anthropos apothane, should die hyper tu lau, for the sake of the people, kai me, and not, that is, instead of, or this first thing is better than the second thing, and not holon ta ethnos, that the whole people or the whole nation, apoletai, should perish, suffer complete destruction. Now here you see laos and ethnos put in parallel to each other, and again you can see that when John uses similar words side by side, he's not often trying to highlight differences, but just use variety in his vocabulary. Tuta de af heautu uk apen. This not from himself, with apa here giving the source, the person who's can claim credit or responsibility for an action. He did not say this from himself, that is, of his own power or wisdom or insight. Allah, rather, that is, on the contrary, archiarus on tu eniautu ekenu, being the high priest, again, in that fateful year, eprophetuzen, he foretold, Hoti emelin Jesus apathnesken hyper tu ethnus, that Jesus was about to die for the sake of the nation, the people. I thought Bedeg's explanation of prophetuo was helpful. It says primarily the meaning is to serve as an interpreter of divine will or purpose, whether or not futurity of the statement is involved. So John's point here is that when Caiaphas said this, he wasn't showing his keen insight, but he was speaking on behalf of God, interpreting his will, even though Caiaphas himself couldn't see the implications of what was happening. Emelin from Melo is, in this case, probably even strengthened by the context here to mean something that's destined, that must happen, if this is being spoken by a prophet for God. Then 52, Kai uch hyper tu ethnus manon. Now this is John drawing out the fuller implications that weren't even apparent to Caiaphas, and not for the people only. that is, for the nation of Israel alone. Rather, hina kai ta tekna tuthau ta diaskorpismena, the scattered children of God, that they also sin agage eis hen, that they might be gathered into one body, one fellowship. And so 53 then, concluding the passage, op ekenes un tes hemeras ebulusanta hina apaktenosin auton. From that day, ekenas tes hemeras, when this report happened and Caiaphas made his prophecy, from that day onward then, ebulusanta, from buluo, the aorist middle, they decided, with hina giving the decision of the course of action they would pursue, that they should apakteno, put him to death, that they should kill him. This is a hard place to say this is the good news or this is the gospel, but that's where the reading ends. Let me close with just a few more homiletical thoughts. I know this has already been a lengthy recording, and you're probably ready to get to your sermon writing. So feel free to do that, but if you have a few more minutes, Kester, in his symbolism book, points out what's sort of a side, I think, point of all of this, but it's a very direct connection with us as readers today and our people as hearers, that when Lazarus is simply identified as the one Jesus loved, that this can make a very direct connection with us. He writes, the story invites readers to identify with its main characters. Rather than using Lazarus' name, the sisters say, Lord, he whom you loved is ill. The message comes from Martha and Mary, yet any number of Jesus' followers could have said, Lord, the one whom you love is ill, when attending to a friend or family member in their own prayers. From a very different source, Augustine's sermon on this miracle, Tractate 49 on the Gospel, has some interesting points for the preacher to consider. He says that this resurrection holds, this miracle, the resurrection of Lazarus, holds a foremost place in preaching. He says it's not because of the wonder of it. Certainly he who made man in the beginning could raise him from the dead. The creation from nothing is in some ways more astounding, more miraculous than a resurrection. But this should be a great cause for rejoicing among the people of God. He said, you've just heard that the Lord Jesus raised a dead man to life. That's sufficient to let you know that, were he so pleased, he might raise all the dead to life. You've seen now demonstrated plainly that he has this power. And indeed, Augustine continues, this very work has he reserved in his own hands until the end of the world. We don't need to see Jesus raise everyone now. All we need is that he's done this as a token of his power so that we might put our trust in him, being prepared for the resurrection, which will be to life and not to judgment. Continuing with some more general thoughts, I found the book by Anthony Kelly and Francis Maloney called Experiencing God in the Gospel of John to be very provocative. And it, I think, will provide some great ideas of themes to pursue, some slightly different ways of looking at John's Gospel as you prepare to preach or to lead a Bible study. There's a section that begins on page 246 of their book called Death and the God of Life. And I won't read it. I'll simply recommend it to you for your consideration. But let me share at least this sentence. The story of Lazarus invites its readers to identify in turn with each of the characters it presents. In a broad sense, it acts as a therapy for faith, recalling believers, whatever their experience of death, to the unconditioned, radical reality of the gift they have received. that as first we look at this through the perspective of the disciples, then through perhaps Lazarus, or at least Martha, and then Mary, and then our Lord himself. And we see that there's a very different way of looking at life and death that emerges when we see this all from the perspective of the one who is the resurrection and the life. Finally, I'm always reminded of C.S. Lewis's poem, Stephen to Lazarus, when I look at either Acts 7 or John 11. And I'll close by reading this for you. Remember, this is Stephen now speaking to Lazarus. "But was I the first martyr who gave up no more than life, while you, already free among the dead, your rags stripped off, your fetters shed, surrendered what all other men irrevocably keep? And when your battered ship at anchor lay, seemingly safe in the dark bay, no ripple stirs obediently, put out a second time to sea, well knowing that your death in vain died once, must all be died again." Again, that's C.S. Lewis, Stephen to Lazarus. I hope you won't think, though, that that's a suggestion that your sermon should focus on Lazarus. Although he's one of the main characters, he gets to speak not a single word. And clearly the focus here is on our Lord himself, and not even his ability simply to work signs, but recall that he's raising his friend back to life as he himself is drawn to Jerusalem, the place where he will meet death. But he won't just conquer death in Bethany. He'll conquer it on Golgotha as well. Well, thank you for your attention as we work through a long passage. I hope it's been as rewarding for you as it has been for me.